Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for you today. My guest is Eleanor Sterling, the curator of the wonderful exhibition going on right now at the American Museum of Natural History called Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, and Culture. And she'll be joining us in a little while talking about the inspiration behind this exhibit and the work that she does at the museum. But before I get to that, I want to tell you about some things going on around the city and some things that are in the news. One thing that, you know, has been coming up in all of the emails I've been getting this week is the issue around the Farm Bill. It seems that the Farm Bill in the House of Representatives has been changed around a bit to cut a lot of the funding for the SNAP program. You know, I know there's been some petitioning, and I think they've reinstated some of that funding. But they still have yet to overhaul the subsidy crop insurance program that they have right now that is so slanted towards the wealthy, big, mega farmers who you know, we'll get that paycheck whether they're farming or not, and it does little to really support the smaller organic farmers that we need to support. So we need everybody out there to get in touch with their House of Representatives and write them a letter and tell them that you want to see some overhaul to the food subsidy programs that right now are not working. And it's pretty much an agreement with everybody other than the big farmers that this needs to be overhauled. And so if you all could do that, you can go on, easily Google your House of Representatives so that you can let them know how you feel about that. Slow Food, if you go to the slowfoodusa.org website, they have information on it, and I think they even have a sample little conversation that you could have with your representative. Also in the news, we have, you know, the new GMO potato being introduced right now. And this potato, just like so many of the GE crops, does not really need to go through any type of testing before it will be approved on the market. And GMOs are just, you know, I personally think they're bad, but what's even worse is that we don't know when we're eating them. And that's why there is so much emphasis right now on states trying to pass legislation that will require foods to be labeled if they are genetically modified. So Connecticut and Maine so far have both passed this kind of legislation, although, at least with Connecticut, it's contingent on 4 other states approving it. So now Maine has approved it, but we still need 3 others, and one of them has to border Connecticut. So there's this little clause in there that is going to make it difficult. So we need Rhode Island or New York or Vermont to also approve this legislation to require labeling. But we all have a right to know what's in our food. And why our government officials don't recognize that right is beyond me. You know, in the European Union, they certainly recognize it. GMOs are banned in so many countries across the world, not just Europe, but Brazil now does it, Japan, Korea. I mean, there's a lot of countries that recognize that we do not have enough research to guarantee that this food that is genetically modified has the same nutritional value and does not have any side effects. So we need everybody to get involved and care about that. So anyway, I wanted to share with you that I'm actually recording the show right now from Detroit. I'm in Detroit for some family events. And so yesterday I met with an old friend of mine, Malik Yakini, who is one of the founders of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And he toured me the D-Town farm, which is a large cooperative farm here in the outskirts of Detroit. And it was just amazing. I'll post some of the pictures on my website. But they have, you know, some hoop houses there. They have acres and acres of cultivated land. They have some bees. You know, and they have so many projects that they're working on. They just got some solar panels that they're going to put up on top of a container so that they can get some electricity there, because that's one of the things that is inhibiting them from growing even more. And it's just a great, great cooperative effort. And, you know, the work that is going on in Detroit around the urban food movement is really inspiring. And you can witness that across the country. It's just really been wonderful. So here for a friend's birthday and graduation party, and I'm going to be checking out some more of the urban projects going on in the city. What else do I want to share with all of you before I move on? Oh, about bees. Yes, I'm very happy to say that we have our two beehives at the IE Green Homestead now, and we're learning about bees. I put my bee suit on for the first time and got close enough where I was able to be surrounded by bees and not be nervous. And I'm really excited because, as so many of you know, the colony collapse disorder is affecting so many of our bees. And even here in Detroit, you know, they had three beehives going right now, but they had double that. And they lost a bunch, you know, over the winter and in the early spring. So this colony collapse disorder is believed to be a result of a certain type of pesticide called neonicotinoids, if I'm saying it right. And that pesticide has actually been banned now in Europe, but once again, it has been approved and continues to be used here in this country. So I don't know what we can do. It just seems like there's so many issues, and I know I keep talking about them, and I don't want to keep, you know, bringing up depressing topics. But the issue that we need to get our politicians to recognize the need to preserve and to support sustainable agricultural practices, because it affects everything. And I did not start as a political activist. I started as a foodie. I loved good food, and I loved vegetarian food that wasn't raising animals for food. And from that root, I had to become involved in politics, because it is all so connected. You cannot be a foodie and not care about the politics around it, because it makes so many decisions and affects our food. And, you know, it's also one of the things I love about food. I love that food is connected to everything that is important in life, you know, community, people, the environment, the economics. It's all connected. And so we all need to do our part to do that. And I'm happy to say over 3,000 people did their part this past Monday up in Albany for the huge anti-fracking rally that took place there. It was really great. I planned on going and last minute was not able to make it, but I had a couple of my interns up there, and they reported back that the energy was ecstatic and that it was really a great, great day. They wished it was even longer. I think that's what they said. You know, it was a little quick. I guess it was organized from 12 to 3, and it could have used to be all day long. You make that big a schlep up there. You know, you really want to get out there and know that the politicians, the people we need to reach, are hearing what we're saying. So that's really, really important. Some things are going on in and around the New York area. Although the summer solstice is being celebrated around the country everywhere. So if you are wherever you are, you can look and see if there's any celebrations to welcome in the summer solstice tomorrow, Friday, June 21st. And On Long Island, our Slow Food Huntington chapter is sponsoring a potluck at the Restoration Farm, and that's from 6 to 8:30. And there's going to be music and great food. It's a potluck, so bring a dish to share. If you have an instrument, bring an instrument to play. And it should be really, really great. Also, outdoor yoga classes are continuing in and around the country. My favorite one near me is at Old Westbury Gardens every Thursday and Saturday morning from 11:15 to 12:30. But doing yoga outside is just, it just feels right. It feels like that's the place to be, and so it's really wonderful. I Eat Green is starting up my cooking classes again. So if you are in the New York area, I'd love to have you join. First one will be next Wednesday, June 26th, then July 3rd, and then I have a new one, July 18th, that I'm co-teaching with Carla Trigo. She's a nutritionist that has recently moved here from Spain. She was teaching this class in Spain, and so I'm supporting her in bringing it to New York. It's a cooking class that supports one's libido, and it is foods that help strengthen your desire and energy around sex. And so if you would like to come to a cooking class to enhance your libido, that is July 18th, and there are tickets available on my website. So go to ieatgreen.com for more information about that. June 30th, Slow Food Huntington is having a small world dinner where we are celebrating everybody's individual heritage and cultures, and we're asking you to bring a local seasonal dish from your heritage and your background. And it's at a home of a member of Slow Foods in Huntington. And when you sign up to come, you will be given the address. So hope you can join us for that. And then July 9th, we're having an edible and medicinal herb walk with Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, on July 9th from 6 to 8. Also, more information about that is on my website. Or you can call Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, directly to register at 800-829-0918. And the last thing is Wednesday, July 10th, Slow Food Huntington is co-presenting with the Cinema Arts Center a screening of Soul Food Junkies. And I talked about that movie before. I actually had Byron Hurt, the director, on the show with me talking about this movie. It is a great, great movie talking about the traditional soul food, how it came to be, the history behind it, and why so much of it is unhealthy. And there's actually going to be a spin on it as to how you can make soul food healthier. And we will be joined by Lisa Dent, the owner of LL Dent Soul Food Restaurant in Carl Place, and she will be providing some healthier soul food for a reception following the movie, as well as speaking to all of us about soul food and her own personal journey, which is pretty amazing. So I hope you can join us for that. So now I'd like to share with you my recipe before I invite Eleanor on. This week I'm sharing with you a corn-encrusted tofu with an artichoke tapenade. And this was a recipe that was inspired. The tapenade was originally made for fish, and I just changed it around a little bit marinated some tofu and put it over tofu, and it's just really great. And one of the things that's so nice is the corn-encrusted tofu has a real crunch to it, and the crunch with the tapenade is just really great. So first you want to marinate the tofu. And so for the marinade, you're going to have 3 tablespoons of water, 2 tablespoons of tamari, 1 tablespoon of mirin, that's Aji Mirin, which is a sweet rice wine. Do not buy the Kokiman brand because that is really corn glucose. It's actually glucose syrup. It's not really sweet rice wine. So once again, just always look at the ingredients and make sure what you're getting is what you think you're getting. In with this marinade, you're going to put 1 teaspoon of chopped garlic. I'm sorry, 2 teaspoons of chopped garlic and 1 teaspoon of minced ginger. And let the tofu slices, you're going to slice the tofu about 1/4 inch thick, and let those slices hang out in the marinade for at least 20 minutes. You can even let it go up to an hour, would be great. And halfway through, turn it over so that the marinade's on both sides. Actually, when I dip it in, I dip it on both sides first so that the marinade is on both sides, and then I also turn it over halfway through. Then we're going to make an egg substitute. You know, I'm doing this dish vegan. If you eat egg, you can certainly just use egg. But for an egg substitute, I mix flax seeds with a liquid. And in this case, I'm using 2 tablespoons of ground flax seeds with 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar and 5 tablespoons of water. And that together makes the consistency of an egg wash. And you're going to use that to dip the tofu in before you put it into the corn crust. And for the corn crust, I buy organic corn flakes. The Erewhon brand I like a lot, but there's other good ones out there. Again, just look at the ingredients, make sure that it's GMO-free corn and organic corn, okay? Then you're going to mix, you're going to ground it up, and you're going to measure out 1.5 cups of the ground corn flakes with 2 tablespoons good-tasting nutritional yeast, and that's different than bread yeast. It's good-tasting nutritional yeast, which I use in my cooking, and you know, it has lots of vitamins. It has B12 in it, which is, you know, something that's challenging for vegetarians to get often, so that's great to use. And also I put in here 1/4 teaspoon of garlic powder. You can also put a little bit of salt in. And that's going to be your corn crust. So you're going to marinate the tofu slices, and while that's marinating, you're going to make the tapenade. And this is what you need for the tapenade. 1 cup chopped celery, 1 onion finely chopped, 1 tablespoon chopped garlic, 1/2 cup organic marinara sauce, 1/2 cup dry white wine, 1/4 cup white wine vinegar, 1 can of artichoke hearts drained and chopped. You can also use frozen ones if you'd like. 1/2 cup of Kalamata olives. Now, if you go on my website, I just want to say that I originally did this dish with green olives, and green olives works fine. However, when I put it over the tofu, the color was just too similar. And when I did it with black olives, it had a much more contrast, and it looked prettier. So you can use green olives if that's what you have, but the Kalamata olives will make the presentation a little nicer. And you're going to chop the olives, 1/4 cup of pine nuts, 3 tablespoons organic sugar, 2 tablespoons of small capers that are drained, 1/4 cup chopped hot peppers, salt and freshly ground pepper, 3 tablespoons chopped basil, and 1 tablespoon chopped parsley. And I know it sounds like a lot of ingredients, but most of the stuff you have in your cupboard, and if you don't, you should. These are all just standard things that should be in your cupboard, and so you're just, you know, opening your refrigerator and pulling out a lot of little jars. That's what the pantry's for. So anyway, while the tofu's marinating, you're going to, in a large skillet, heat up the olive oil. You're going to add the celery and the onions and the garlic and cook until they're softened for about 5 minutes. Then add the tomato sauce, the vinegar, the wine, the artichokes, the olives, the pine nuts, the sugar, and capers. And cook that up. You can season it with some salt and pepper. Then add the hot peppers and cook until the vegetables are soft and the liquid is reduced, about 10 minutes. Stir in the basil and parsley and transfer to a dish and let it cool down. And that's the tapenade. So now you're going to lay out a double thick piece of paper towel, or you can use a dish towel if you'd like. Remove the tofu from the marinade and lay it out on the paper towel just to dry it a little bit. So you can also put another towel or paper towel on top and just, you know, tap it down so that you're drying off most of the marinade. Then you're going to dip it into the mixture of the flaxseed water and apple cider vinegar and dip it, you know, the same way you would with an egg wash. And then dip it into the ground cornflakes, nutritional yeast, and garlic powder mixture. And I usually put that into like a flat pie pan, or you can even use a plate. But, you know, one that has a little bit of a side to it so that the corn crust doesn't fall all over the place. So you're going to dip it both sides into the corn mixture, and then you're going to I wipe out the same heavy skillet that I made the tapenade with and heat up some olive oil and saute each of the pieces of tofu on both sides until golden brown. If you'd like, you can also dip it into the corn crust and lay it out on a well-oiled, with olive oil, cookie sheet, you know, that's lined with parchment paper, and spray the top of the cutlets with olive oil and bake it in a 400-degree oven for about 20 minutes to get golden brown. And that uses a little bit less oil, and it is equally good. Halfway through, you know, you might want to turn them over so that both sides get equally golden brown. And You know, that's nice instead of frying it on top of the oven. I do that a lot, and it works really well. And then you're going to serve it immediately with the tapenade on top. And it's just a great dish. You know, just I'm sure you'll love it. Please send me feedback. I love hearing from everybody how the recipes worked out and whether or not you liked them, if you did anything different with them. So please, you know, sign on to my website, iegreen.com, and send me some comments. And this recipe will also be posted on the PRN website and in their archives, so you can always tap into the recipes at a later date. So now I would like to introduce formally my guest, Eleanor Sterling, the director for the Center of Biodiversity and Conservation at the American Museum of Natural History. And in her position there, she leads the development and coordination of all of the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation's national and international field projects. In 2001, Dr. Sterling spearheaded the establishment of the CBC's Network of Conservation Educators and Practitioners, which works to create and implement educational materials and teaching resources for biodiversity conservation at both the undergraduate, graduate, and professional levels around the world. She's curated 6 exhibitions at the museum, including the one going on right now, Our Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, and Culture, which is currently on view and is a great show. If you haven't seen it yet, it is closing the beginning of August, so you really want to get there. In her capacity as a conservation biologist, Dr. Sterling has almost 30 years of field research experience in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where she conducted behavioral, ecological, and genetic studies of primates, whales, and sea turtles. She's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University. And from 2002 to 2012, she was the director of graduate studies for the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Environmental Biology at Columbia. She's a graduate of Yale College and also got her master's and PhD at Yale University. And so I'd like to welcome Eleanor. Are you there?
I am. Thank you.
I'm so glad you could make it on. I'm really, really happy to have you because I love your exhibit at the museum.
I'm delighted to be here, and it's an honor to share this time with you.
Thank you. So can you first tell me what was the catalyst behind the exhibition, and why did the Museum of Natural History, a history museum, decide that this was an important exhibition to have?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, the museum has been taking on some of the major issues in the world today and recognizing its role as a conduit of information for people and the decisions that they need to be making about stewardship of the earth. And so this is one in a series of exhibits that we've been doing. We did one on extinction. We did one on the genome, the genomics. And we did one on water, which I curated, and water stewardship issues, and then one on climate change. So food made a lot of sense in the context of that series about what people really need to know to make effective, responsible decisions about stewarding the earth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great. And I didn't even know about those other exhibits. So, you know, I hope they happen again.
Yeah, well, you can go on our website too and learn some more about those exhibits. Also, the water exhibition that I curated in 2007 is still traveling. We had to make 2 copies because it was quite popular, so it's still traveling around various places in the United States and the world.
Where is it now? You know,
it's opening in Kansas next year, and I just got a message about where the exhibit is. Let me find out, and you can ask me another question. I can come back to you about
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
It's great to follow its travel. I wish I could travel as much. Oh, it's opening in Parque Explora in Medellin, Mexico. It opens today.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, it's such an important issue. I mean, you know, if you heard any of the beginning of my talk, I was just, you know, for me, I started as a natural food chef, and you know, you can't really care about your food and not get involved in some of the politics and where it's coming from. You know, I didn't know about so many of these issues 35 years ago. Actually, many of the issues weren't even relevant 35 years ago. And over time, though, as you, you know, learn more and more, you realize the need to educate more people about it.
Yeah, and to understand the connections. I think, you know, people really separate out water from food, from energy, and in fact, they're all completely interrelated. And the decision that we make on a day-to-day basis about what food we eat has implications for lots of our human health, for the health of our families, for the health of our environment, other species, mm-hmm. And the water that we use, that we extract from the earth to support agriculture. You know, 75% of the water that humans take out of the system is used for agriculture.
Right, right. And so much of it is used in the production of meat. I mean, that was one of the reasons I stopped eating meat over 40 years ago. It was when I found out how many gallons of water it takes to create 1 pound of meat. It was just unbelievable. And I just saw at that time, you know, in the book I read, Diet for a Small Planet, it just was not a sustainable way of producing meat and feeding the world.
Right. I think that we have a lot of choices that we need to be considering when we're making choices, and one of them is the resources that go into the various kinds of food that we're starting to depend on now.
Right, right. And as more and more people start eating those foods.
Exactly.
So can you talk about some of the unique features of the exhibition that visitors may not be expecting?
Yeah, I think, in fact, the whole organization of the exhibit is probably not what people would expect. And in thinking about a Museum of Natural History and thinking about what the message would be from the Museum of Natural History, I bet a lot of people think, oh, it's, you know, kitchens from around the world, or it's starting with what our human ancestors ate and moving through to what astronauts might eat. And instead, we took on the whole food system and tried to give people this broad overview of where our food comes from, the food that's on our plate, both from a historical context of where we domesticated it and why, but then also really the growing, the trade and transportation, the preparation, and then the celebration around eating. And walking people through those steps helps us to make better decisions. I mean, a lot of people focus in, for instance, on food miles, which is only the transportation part of the how food gets onto our plate. And so we really wanted to give a big picture overview, which was a daunting choice because people aren't used to thinking systemically, really. We're not, in more recent times, we've been sort of trained to segment everything so that we're looking at everything in smaller packages, and that's an easier way to conceptualize things, but that you lose a lot of those important connections and a lot of better decision making because we're partitioning our thoughts and our ideas into much smaller units. So we really wanted to take on the whole thing and mm-hmm. and see if we could get people to think more systemically about the decision making about food, and also to really appreciate the celebration aspects. Mm-hmm. That's really key for us.
Yeah, it is. It's key for me too in my life. It's, and it's one of the reasons I connect so much with slow food, because it cares about the hows and whys and where it's coming from, but also you don't want to lose that celebration part. And that's why sometimes when people become too rigid, it takes some of the pleasure out of, you know, being able to celebrate.
Absolutely. So we really wanted the exhibition to take on some of the hard questions and get people to assess them, but also to really be fun and mm-hmm. and make them rethink their relationship with food and the importance of food to our daily life, but also to our spiritual and celebration.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about breaking things up into small partitions, you know, I think, you know, we tend to do that in so many aspects of our life today. You know, the healthcare system does that. I mean, I remember my husband had a bad thumb, and we went to a hand specialist, and you know, but the hand specialist only specialized in the wrist. We had to go to someone else who specialized in the thumb. You know, it's like even the part of just the hand got compartmentalized. So often, you know, it's also hard finding doctors that look at the whole system. You know, everyone's looking at their little parts, and, you know, and when they prescribe medicines, you know, they, you know, look at one medicine that's good for one thing, but they're not looking at it in conjunction with everything. You know, when they do immunization, you know, this, you know, vaccination might work for one thing, but they, in the context of everything else that everyone's taking in, is it good? You know, it's just, it's really hard.
Yeah, and one of the things that I talked a lot about when I think about food and our whole healthcare system, not just for us, but for veterinary care, you know, people, I have a colleague, Andres Gomez, who's a veterinarian, but also a PhD scientist in ecology and evolution. And he brought his veterinary training to thinking about our food system and our environment. And he said, you know, my job as a veterinarian is to make a single cow better. So if a cow has a stomach disease, then I give it the strongest antibiotics or the strongest medicine that can cure that individual cow. But when the cow excretes that medicine and it's still an active compound that can actually kill off dung beetles and other organisms that are living in the environment, and those dung beetles keep down the flies and make sure that the whole herd is actually healthy. So if you want to fix using the best medication the health of one individual cow, you may actually cause conditions in the environment that could sicken the whole herd.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, you know, who's my patient? Is my patient the cow? Is my patient the herd? Is my patient the whole ecosystem that can support healthy individual cow, but also health in the broad aspect of the world? So those are questions that are hard, you're right, but there are decisions that we could be making that are thinking beyond just the hand or the thumb. Or the single cow that are longer-term decisions that are overall better for all of us.
Right. Well, that's been in the news, you know, in the recent year as well. And I'm sure you addressed it in your water exhibit. You know, all the medications that people are taking now that's getting into our water system, and you look at the whole environmental impact that's having. You know, it's not being filtered out of our water, and so. You know, the chemo medicines, the antibiotics, everything.
Yeah, the hormones, absolutely. and that was in our exhibition, and much more research has happened since then. So I'm glad that people are focusing in on it and we're thinking about it, and we can do a better job of understanding, A, how to dispose of medications that we don't need, but also how to think about filtering the systems for the medications that we are taking. So,
mm-hmm.
And those, you know, certainly affect the environment, and we don't really know how they affect other aspects of our lives as well. So,
right. Eleanor, can we take a couple minute break? And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the advice you have to share with people about the choices that they can make in the food that they eat and buy. Okay?
Sure, sounds great.
All right, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Eleanor Sterling, Director of Center of Biodiversity and Conservation at the American Museum of Natural History. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Eleanor Sterling, the Director for the Center of Biodiversity and Conservation at the American Museum of Natural History. Eleanor, are you with us?
Yes.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So we're talking about the wonderful exhibit you have, Our Global Kitchen. And I wanted to just ask you to share with people what advice you could give them on trying to make more informed choices about the food that they buy.
Yeah, I think that we have a lot of good decisions that we can make. One of them is just the principle of thinking about diversity. Trying to diversify your diet is good for you from a health perspective, and it's also good for the environment so that we don't really rely on such few species. We have about 40% of the calories that humans consume come from just three species, rice, wheat, and corn. And there are lots of other species out there that we could be eating and buying and creating markets around that would help farmers and communities, but also you know, really be useful for us in our individual health as well. And also really fun and interesting to explore new tastes and new recipes, as you're helping us to do in your show as well.
Uh-huh. Now, when you say 40%, That's of grain. What about of meat?
No, it's actually 40% of all the calories consumed come from those three grains.
Wow. Wow, I had no idea.
It's a pretty incredible reliance on just a few things. And from a biological standpoint, you know, one of the things we always should be thinking about is not fighting against nature, but working with nature to produce our foods and to make the decisions we have about food. So we, in some of the decisions we make about how we grow things and also what we eat, we're really working against natural systems. If we're spending a lot of time creating a lot of monocultures and growing all of one kind of thing, there are lots of insects and fungi and pests out there that would be thrilled, that are thrilled, to take advantage of having such an incredible food source for them too. And by diversifying our farm systems and the way we grow things, we can actually best fight against some of these horrible problems that we face with diseases taking over our plants and our crops.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that I think people can think of. Another thing that's really important for us to think about is there's still 870 million people who are food insecure and undernourished. And we really need to be thinking about how can we produce enough food but also distribute enough food to feed the world's population. And one of the major problems with that is not just production, but it's also the fact that we waste 30% of the food that we produce globally. Perfectly good food that's nutritious and wonderful, but for lots and lots of reasons, we don't eat it. One of the big reasons that happens in the United States is people are really concerned about the aesthetics of their food. They go to the grocery store and they want to pick an apple that has a tiny blemish or it's a funny shape. And people throw away a lot of food that's funny shaped before it even gets to the consumer because they're concerned the consumer won't buy it. So I think we need to expand our vision of what's delicious. One of the best things that I learned while I was doing the exhibition, we were researching a diorama, a wonderful diorama we have in the exhibit that's Aztec market in 1519, just before the Spaniards came, and thinking about what local foods looked like in the Americas then. And when we first saw the version of the exhibit that the exhibition department came up with, all the tomatoes were all red. And I thought about that, and I realized that when I was younger, that certainly wasn't the case. And so we looked into it, and we realized, of course, that the tomatoes in the Aztec market would not have been all red. And as I started to research that some more, I learned that there's a gene that causes the tomatoes to ripen all at once that has been forwarded in our tomatoes that we eat out of the supermarkets today, but that gene is linked with a gene that gives the tomato its robust flavor. So you actually have to decide at this point whether you want the all-ripe red tomato or the robust flavor. And so the best thing to do is not go to the supermarket or your store or your farmer and choose the all-ripe tomato, but to choose the tomato that has kind of a green shoulder and that is several different colors. And people, those are always the last ones in the supermarket because people don't like those. Mm-hmm. But just because of the way they look, but in fact they taste much better than the all-ripe tomatoes. So, you know, I think relaxing our vision of what we think is pretty and edible and what's useful is really key in redistributing food and thinking of ways that we can more efficiently use the food that we raise already.
Mm-hmm.
Just by making some aesthetic choices, I think, is really key.
Yeah. You know, there was a wonderful event that took place in Berlin a few years ago that they talked about this past year when I was at Terra Madre in Italy. But it was an event that that the slow food organizers put on there where they asked all farmers, people to bring all food that would have been thrown out that what had blemishes and whatever. And thousands of people came and helped cook on the streets in Berlin, and they sat down to a huge festival. I think I don't know how many thousands of people that they fed. But they showed how you could create such delicious food. I mean, an apple has a blemish. Well, then cut it up and make apple strudel, you know?
Exactly.
Applesauce, you know, there's so many things you can do with, you know, you're cutting up the vegetable for a blemish. You cut the blemish part out. And I know as someone who's growing vegetables, I'm much more willing to eat my own greens that have, you know, little little holes in it that some bug ate, because you know, I washed it and I know I grew it, you know, and I don't care when I'm cutting it up and in the stir fry, you don't see those little holes, and it's great.
Yeah,
but I certainly, you know, if I was going to a farmer's market, I too would probably pick the greens that don't have little holes in them, you know. So it's funny how, you know, at least for me, when I grow it, I'm much more willing to cut around all the bruises or the, you know, cut the worm out, you know, that's inside the zucchini and eat the good part, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, some of the messages that one of the things we researched during the exhibition was some of the messages that, say, the USDA were telling people in the 1900s, early 1918 or whatever, and they're all still the same messages, so it's not a big secret what we should be doing, you know, eat lower in the food chain, try to not eat too much. So those are all messages that have been really winding through public service messages for a very long time, and yet we don't do it. If you look in the exhibition, we show the average portion size from 1950 and then the present, and you can see that there's an incredible increase in the size of the portions that are served us, and to a large extent also the size of the portions that we're eating. And if we don't eat it, then it gets thrown away, and if we do eat it, that contributes to the over 1 billion people in the world that are obese. And we need to, that's not the only thing, of course, that's causing obesity, but we need to really be thinking about I when I go out and somebody serves me food, I eat more than I should or than I want to, and I don't listen to my stomach because it's there and it's available, and it just seems like the thing I should be doing. And I think we can all make better choices by just being more responsible and thoughtful about portion sizes, about what we're eating, and the quantity as well as the type of foods that we're eating.
Mm-hmm. There's also, you know, a lot of programs where you can bring leftovers to, you know, I was involved in a group with a program called From Our Table to Yours. And so when you do have leftovers, you know, I've been to so many parties where people are leaving and, you know, everyone's dishing out leftovers for people to take with them to, you know, because everyone doesn't have it left at their house. But there's a lot of, you know, soup kitchens and places where you can bring leftovers rather than throwing it out. And we all, I think, need to participate in being aware of how much is wasted and thrown out.
Yeah, yeah. And the exhibit has a really great graphic that shows you that in some places in the world, the food loss is actually more at the field level or the storage or the transportation level, because people don't have the resources that we do in developed countries to refrigerate, to transport food in refrigerated trucks and things like that. And so I think it's important for us to think about how different parts of the world really have different challenges, I think, in these issues. But certainly in the United States and many of the other developed countries, we really could do a much better job of reducing waste at the consumer and the retail end.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you said most of the 40% of the calories come from wheat, rice, and corn, right?
Mm-hmm.
What other grains do you recommend that people start experimenting with?
Yeah, there's sorghum, there's quinoa. You know, some of these we have to think, too, about the impact that our purchasing has on the farmers in the places where we're getting the food from.
Right, I read that article on the quinoa.
Yeah, but there are ways to do that, you know, to create markets that don't definitively put huge pressure on local communities. And I think we just need to be thoughtful and know our farmers and work with farmers who are experimenting with different things. You can grow quinoa in lots of different places, and you can find ways of buying quinoa where the local communities are supported by the system and not exploited by a system in terms of where the food comes from.
Right. Just let me just say, for those that might not have seen the article I'm referring to, it just was talking about how, you know, the pressure of growing more and more quinoa has made it unaffordable for the people that normally were eating it, the local people, and it was all being exported, and so they weren't getting the quinoa that, you know, provided their nutrients for so long.
Yeah, it's a complex problem, as with all things. And the wonderful and the challenging thing about food is that everything's all connected to the politics, to the to the economies, to the cultures and societies. So there's also millets that have been grown in Asia for over 6,000 years. And lots of people in India and Nepal, for instance, are now starting to switch from growing crops like corn or maize and rice back to some of the traditional varieties that were bred on those mountainsides.
So there's more than one type of millet, I gather.
Yeah.
Are you just saying millet?
No. There are many types of millet.
Yeah.
And there are actually many types of wheat. There are certain wheat types like emmer wheat. They require less fertilizer, fewer pesticides, and places like Turkey are starting to grow emmer wheat now that may show up in our markets sometime
and
soon.
Something that's really interesting about emmer wheat, a lot of people who have wheat allergies are not allergic to emmer wheat.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it has less of the gluten in it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting, and it's interesting, you know, when you look at the expanse of wheat allergies, the wheat that's being grown now has, I think, something like 80% more gluten than the wheat had when I was younger.
Yeah, lots and lots of changes, I think, that are sometimes good for people who grow the wheat, but not necessarily good for the people who eat the foods. It's not just wheat, but lots of different choices that we're making right now in our food production. The other thing that we don't think enough about, and this is partly our culture and aesthetic, is foods that are really easy to grow and very nutritious, like algae or insects, that we culturally don't necessarily want to embrace. And yet, I love to give a presentation where I show a picture of insect larvae right next to shrimp. And people, when I first show the insect larvae, people all say, ew, I wouldn't eat that. And then I show the shrimp, and they don't look that different. And yet some of the people in the audience love the shrimp, but they wouldn't eat the insect larvae. And just trying to think again about where and how we get our aversions to food and how much of it is cultural.
Right.
And how much we could do a better job of thinking about what's sustainable and easy to grow, and like some insects. And lots and lots of cultures around the world really enjoy insects and find wonderful and tasty ways to cook grasshoppers or ants or other insects. And so I think that's another thing we could be thinking about is broadening the horizon of what's edible for us culturally.
Right, right. You're so right, because, you know, I have the same aversion that I'm sure so many people have, just thought of it.
Yep.
But, you know, I know it's completely cultural, completely. So can you share with us some of the interesting science stories that came out of the exhibition that you think will be new for most people?
Yeah, you know, so one of the things we did in the kitchen, in the exhibition that was really different is the first time we've ever done this, is we put a kitchen in the middle of the exhibit. We did that for a couple of reasons. The first one is that, of course, you're going to walk through an exhibition and you're going to start get hungry if you're thinking and talking about food all the time. So we wanted to have some wonderful taste treats with local foods and give people a sense for the diversity of tastes that that are out there in the world. But one of the other major reasons we did that is because so much of the really interesting new science about food is coming out of the taste field, the field of neurogastronomy, which has to do with the brain mechanisms that allow you to taste flavor or to sense flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talk in the exhibition in the kitchen about all the different senses that go into your appreciation of food. And most of us think that our tongue tells us whether something tastes good or not, whether the flavor of something is good or not. And in fact, our tongue is only capable of sensing five things: sweet, sour, salt, bitter, and savory. And so what we do in the exhibit is that we have a little experiment that people do where they plug their nose and they eat a half of a jelly bean, and they tell people what they sense. And generally the only thing they can sense is sweet, but they don't know the flavor of the jelly bean until they chew the other half of the jelly bean and open their nose, their nasal passage. And that's because flavor is about an interrelationship between that sweet sensation we get from our tongue, but also smell sensors. And so that's why when you have a cold, you can't really taste food very well and you don't appreciate food very well, or people who have particular medications or medical conditions where they don't, their nose isn't working very well, they don't appreciate food in the same way the rest of us do. And so we really got people to think about some exciting new research that's happening on the tastes and the flavor sensations. And people in Europe, in England, there's somebody who's doing some research on the sound, the importance of sound to your food. So he basically took Pringle potato chips, which, of course, is a perfect experimental unit, because those Pringles are all exactly the same, and he blindfolded and people and fed them chips, and they're all exactly the same chip, but he had headphones on them, and so if they heard the sound of soggy chips, they thought they tasted bad, and if they heard the sound of crisp chips, they really liked them. So again, there's so many things that go into our appreciation for food, and so many senses that we have, that's an exploration that we go into in the exhibition, is all the research that people are doing right now about the parts of the brain that come into play mm-hmm. in your appreciation for food.
Right, and of course, the visual. I mean, how many times you bring something out to a table and the kid says, ugh, I don't like that, before they even taste it, just by the look of it.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? We definitely. There's also a study that we feature in the exhibit that's pretty fun, where they took experts in wine tasting and they gave them different wines, and one of them was a white wine that they had doctored with red food coloring, and the wine experts gave all red taste sensations for the wine, even though they were experts and technically should have known better, but because they were looking at a red wine, their mind gave them the elements that would describe a red wine. So
interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. Before we end, though, can you share with us any surprises that came to you when you were putting together this exhibition?
Yeah, there were so many. I learned so much from this exhibit. One of them that really was a pleasant surprise was the fact that so much is going on in our world today. There was a inspirational story from Kenya about how people were using their knowledge of nature to be able to do a better job of growing their food. They were growing corn, and there were two problems they were facing. One of them was weeds, and the other one was a stem borer that killed the corn. And people in Kenya had a very good knowledge of how the different environmental elements interacted, and they realized that this insect that was boring into the corn was repelled by a particular plant, a vine that could grow at the base of the corn, and that vine also produced a chemical that stopped the other weeds from growing. So they grow this vine at the base of the corn that would push the insect away from the corn because the insect didn't like the smell, and they grew another a grass at the edge of the field that pulled the insect into the grass and then was sticky, and the insect got stuck in the grass and died in there. And they would cut down the grass and feed the grass to neighboring cows, and then use the manure from the cows to fertilize the system. So it was exciting for me to see this working with nature and learning about how people who work on diversified farms, both internationally, and this was a case from Kenya that I was just telling you about, it's called push-pull technology, because it pushes the insect away from the corn and pulls it to the edge of the crop. But there's also a lot of great diversified farms that are happening in the States. There's some really great work that's happening in California, where some of the farms are growing more than 80 crops and finding ways really to sustain the bees and insects and pest controlling wildlife, like, for instance, you were talking about at the beginning of this session. And then also had, reasonable high yield and good economic returns on this investment in diversified farming. And so that was an exciting and interesting find for me, that so much of this is happening not just on an experimental level, but at a larger scale
mm-hmm.
In various places around the world.
Thank you. Well, it's really been so great having you on. The exhibition is wonderful. It's going till when? August?
August 11th. So
August
come by.
11th. So where do people go to get tickets? Because I know it can be really crowded.
Yeah, so if they come in the 81st Street entrance, so you can get tickets there, or at the 79th Street entrance. And they can get tickets online.
You can get tickets online. Okay, great.
Well,
Eleanor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Eleanor from the Center of Biodiversity and Conservation at the American Museum of Natural History. And, of course, I'm Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Have a great one. Bye-bye. Bye, Eleanor.
Bye, thanks.